You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Mr. Weaver, Mr. Ray. Good morning. I'm here on behalf of Appellant Fisher & Frichtel, Inc. This case, the first case on your docket, deals with a reexamination as to how to measure a deficiency in a case where there is a deficiency sought after a foreclosure sale. The fundamental question here is, how do you value real estate taken by foreclosure? It's going to be valued one way or the other, either in the current system by the bid, the price that the bank decides to bid at foreclosure, or as we are requesting that the court adopt the restatement of property, section 8.4, so that a fair market value standard would be used.
What states follow the 8.4?
Your Honor, there are approximately 35 states that go with some portion or some fair market value standard. Not all of them follow 8.4 specifically, but 35 of them have some type of fair market standard.
I'm only aware of one state, Tennessee, that for a while followed the restatement, and now it's been superseded by statute. Is there any case that's adopted what you're asking us to do based solely on the restatement, change their current law based on that?
Judge Stith, I cannot say that any of these states have wholly adopted every aspect of their statement.
But the aspect that you're asking us to adopt is what I'm asking about. Is there any state that's done so and follows it that didn't already do that under their common law?
Yes. There are six states that have adopted it judicially. The list of those states, including Tennessee, Florida.
The ones that are cited in the restatement when they adopt it. But I was 1997, so I looked to try to find states that might have adopted it since 1997, and I did not find any except Tennessee where there's fraud. So I'm wondering why you think that is, that it hasn't stirred more interest or caused more states to adopt judicially what you're asking us to do today.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the majority of the states have adopted some version of a fair market value standard. Most of them have done it through statutory means. But here in Missouri, the standard that we follow currently was court-made law. This is a case, the most recent decision by this court with respect to this issue was back in 1940 in the Dranick case. The court has made this law. In this instance, I believe it is appropriate for the court to update the law and bring it more contemporary with current standards.
Why is it not more appropriate for the legislature to do that?
Judge, I believe that the reason why it is not more appropriate for the legislature to do that is because this is court-made law. The legislature did not make this law in the first place. The court back in 1940, citing to what it believed was contemporary standards, the Corpus Juris Secundum, made the law as it stands now. Now we are here in 2012, and that contemporary standard has changed. As I said, over 35 states have adopted a fair market value standard.
And in those states, was it statutory prior to them changing, adopting a statute that included fair market value?
Judge, I will be honest with you. I can't go through you state by state as to whether there was a statutory provision before or not. What I can tell you is that six of those states did it specifically by judicial decision. Here in Missouri, since there is no statute at all that covers this field, I believe it's appropriate for the court to act because it is a court-made standard which is causing the unfairness which resulted in this case.
What weight should we be giving to the restatement? I know there's a restatement of torts, a lot of restatements. What weight should we be giving, if at all, to the restatement of property?
We have cited another number of decisions of this court and courts of Missouri where they have adopted the restatement of property. It is a restatement which this court and Missouri courts have routinely adopted because it makes fair, balanced decisions with respect to the risk and the rights of the parties involved. Here, the restatement, section 8.4, does that again. It gives a balanced approach to both protect the rights of the lender and the banks and to protect the rights of the borrower.
Now, ostensibly on a foreclosure, you have a property's foreclosed, there's notice given, and then there's the idea would be to be a willing seller and a willing buyer, which would normally be what the value of the property would be. You saying you'd have an appraiser in instead who would then say what they think the property should be worth?
Yes, Judge, because as we cited in the Shirley case, a price paid at foreclosure is not fair market value because it's not a willing seller and a willing buyer. The facts showed in this case that 20 days notice.
But a willing seller is the person who takes over the property.
That's
so
a willing buyer.
If not a willing seller, they wouldn't sell it.
No, but the seller is the borrower. who is being foreclosed on. They are not a willing seller. And if you look at the Shirley case, it clearly indicated that a price paid at foreclosure does not constitute fair market value. So there has to be another way to establish fair market value, and it's a way that we do it in almost all other contexts, which is for a licensed Missouri appraiser to come in and give an opinion as to value.
Why is that a better reflection of what fair market value is than some sort of open auction? I mean, isn't that one of the reasons where there was so many failures, is that people relied on certified appraisers and it turned out that it really wasn't a proper reflection of what the fair market was?
Judge Fisher, I think if you look at the facts of this case, we established quite clearly that the foreclosure process does not get to a fair value. What we had here was 20 days notice. The vice president for the bank, who had also been a loan officer for 10 plus years prior to being a workout guy, said the shortest possible time that he could conceive that somebody could come into his bank, ask for a loan to buy a commercial property, and go through the process to close was 45 days.
Isn't that more of a complaint? Isn't there a statute that governs how much time you have, or how is that time set? So is that more something for the legislature to say this is simply not reasonable and they should change what the statutory time is?
Judge Sith, the what we are asking to do here makes no change to the statutory foreclosure process. The bank can go in and take the property within the 20 days and pay whatever price it wants. Right now there is no protection, though, that if the bank then decides to seek a deficiency judgment, how then is the value of the property that was taken at the foreclosure to be properly valued?
And I understand all the equitable and public policy arguments in favor of what you're arguing about, and clearly there's a variety of ways the courts in different states address it, depending on how they weigh that argument and the other ones. You're asking us to come in here kind of after the fact, change the law that was in existence at the time this contract was entered into, and opposing counsel says that the note or the contract provides how the deficiency will be determined, and you're asking us to do something different. I mean, I understand your policy arguments why in this day and age and with everything going on, there needs to be, you think a different rule would be better, but doesn't the contract rule this case, and if that was agreed to, then that's what's going to have to decide this case, whatever happens in the future?
I certainly understand that's the argument that the banks have made. I disagree. It is not measured by the contract here. The language that they cite in the deed of trust really just begs the question. It says you owe the deficiency. Well, the question is, how do you measure that deficiency? There is nothing in the deed of trust.
But does it say you're borrowing this much money, here's how much you owe, if you don't pay, we'll foreclose and you'll pay the deficiency? That could be read to mean the difference between that and fair market value, where it doesn't mention that?
It does not mention fair market value. What it just simply uses is that term deficiency, which is a term of art, term used in the law, which can be defined and has been defined by the courts, and which we believe should be defined as the difference between the amount owed on the loan and the fair market value.
Well, in this case, the fair market value is less than what the property was originally purchased for.
Correct.
What if the case was where the fair market value had increased? Then wouldn't that result in a windfall for the bank?
In that instance, it may result in a windfall for the bank, which the restatement provides is acceptable. There is no requirement under the restatement that if the property appraises in excess of the fair market value or in excess of the amount due on the note, that there's any payback that comes to the borrower.
But if it's in excess of the value and the bank collects that, then they have to give that money. It's an above the money owed to the debtor.
Well,
if the debtor owed $200,000 and the bank got $300,000 for the property, they'd have to give that extra $100,000 to the debtor.
Not under the restatement provision, Your Honor. It specifically provides that if the fair market value of the property exceeds the amount owed, that the bank does not owe the difference. Because really, what this is doing is it's properly.
If they sold it for more. Not just the valuing, but they sold it for more.
Well, Judge, that is part of the unfairness that we're trying to avoid. We made reference in response to the business bank's amicus curiae brief of a situation where I'm involved in another case where the bank took the property for $2 million at foreclosure. 4 months later, sold it for $2.65 million.
Is that in the record?
That is in the record, Your Honor. I mean, it's not in the trial record, but it is in response to arguments made by the business bank. And that's an example.
So do we have in the record the statistics on how many cases sell for more and the banks receive what you call a windfall? Do we know other than anecdotally one case?
Well, what we have, Your Honor, is we have the evidence in this case where it is clear that the bank has put themselves in a position to obtain a windfall by seeking approximately $500,000 more in value received than the underlying debt. They received property of foreclosure that was worth $918,000. They came in and sought a deficiency of $675,000, which adds up to $1.5 million on a $1.1 million debt. That's the evidence we have in the record here. I understand, Your Honor, that the Bankers Association has come in and tried to put in statistics and information. Amicus for the business bank tried to do the same thing. And by responding with that one situation that I'm familiar with, I just wanted to show the information that I have.
Isn't there an accounting rule that the banks during the financial crisis or whatever, the banks got an accounting rule change that the banks value the property at mark to market? Even though the property they may be holding may be substantially lower in value, they're allowed to put it on their books at what they bought it for, some mark. Is that the?
Your Honor, there are various different accounting rules and regulations as to how the banks treat the value of the property on their own books. But I think you do raise an important point. Counsel for the banks has talked about, you know, we have to get appraisals. This is going to cause difficulty in getting appraisals. These banks are getting appraisals of the property all the time. This particular bank got an appraisal of the property at $675,000 right before it did the foreclosure, and then went in and decided to pay only $466,000, and has admitted that they unfairly double discounted the price of carry in coming up with that bid. That is the situation.
But there
right
were no
now,
other bids. They could have bid $200,000.
They could have. There's no
other
protection.
Way of measuring it except for how much money they were going to bid for the property they're putting up for sale.
There's no protection under the current law.
Well, currently under Missouri law, to invoke equity, you've got to be able to show that there's been some unfair dealing, some mistake in the trustee sales, some substantial irregularity. Are you alleging any of those things?
No, because we're not attempting to set aside the sale.
You're alleging that, or you're trying to change the law to 8.4.
How we measure the deficiency, yes, Your Honor. I believe my time is up for my main part of my argument.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Tom Weaver, and I represent Respondent First Bank. I'd like to respond to some of the questions that were asked with regard to Judge Stith, your question about what the note says, what the note provides, and the deed of trust provide, that if there is a default, then the lender or the bank can sell, or the trustee shall sell the property to the highest bidder for cash, and that the borrower shall be responsible for the deficiency.
Now, opposing counsel says deficiency is not defined in the deed of trust, so that begs the question, do we define it as the difference between the debt and the amount sold for, or the debt and fair market value?
The deficiency is not defined in the agreement. Our position is, and we think it's the reasonable and fair position, is that the when you read that, what that suggests clearly is that it's going to be sold and there's going to be a deficiency, and that implicitly is going to be measured by what it was sold for. And also the other
how
aspect.
How does the bank in this situation, where there's one bid being the bank that holds the note, decide how much to pay? Well, if they decide to pay $100,000, there are other bids, or they decide to pay $50,000 or $10,000?
Two responses, Your Honor. First of all, the testimony in the record, page 161, there's an explanation about why they bid what they bid, which was they had an appraisal for $675,000. They made additional reductions to that based on the status of the market, how what the additional carrying costs would be, the fact that it was going to be bought by somebody who was not a residential developer, so it was different than a situation where a residential developer, what they might be willing to pay. So there was a reason for a further reduction. And what the appellant does in their brief and repeatedly is they will cite the testimony about the difference between the 675 and 466, but they never direct the court, as we do in our brief, to the explanation about why there is that difference.
Your opponent argues that, in fact, I may be wrong, but a vice president testified that they had computed double the costs of holding the property. And so, in fact, it wasn't a reasonable price, and they admitted that.
I disagree with that characterization of the evidence. If you look at the testimony 159 to 161 in the transcript where he explains what he did, there's some deposition testimony he read where he suggests that that's a double discount. But he explains why it was appropriate in the context of this market.
Where he also claims that it's possible the bank is just holding the property and not even trying to sell it to demonstrate the reasonableness of that figure, rather than to go forward and market it and potentially get a much higher that sales price for the property.
Well, the evidence in the record, Your Honor, is that efforts that it was on the market for $675,000 during the time between the time of foreclosure and the time of trial, and they were unable to sell it, got no bids on it for $675,000. And if you're looking to buy 9 lots of property, I can tell you where you can find it for substantially less than the $466,000 that was paid for it.
But there are no bids at 466 either. Is there any, where would there have been bids, or is that, there's no market for that property whatsoever?
Well, I think that it's a reflection of the market that they haven't been able to sell the property, Your Honor, at amounts.
So are you still holding it?
The bank still has the property and is still attempting to sell it and is still marketing it, and this is not in the record, but that's the reality of it.
Is that what you were saying the second discount was, is discounting it because of the slow market?
Looking,
you get less, or how, why wasn't it double counting?
It was looking at a slow market, a market in which prices were dropping, and I think it highlights the problem, the problem. And again, what this case involves is a policy decision about whether you're going to change 100 years of law. And even though this court hasn't ruled on it in quite some time, this rule has been applied, and up the one of the cases cited was in 2009.
Can you address the other part of the question? What if we didn't have these facts, and assume we saw the facts in the light most favorable, as you said? What if someone had paid $50,000? What if there had been a bank that had not done all this effort that you talk about and had paid $50,000 or $100,000 for this property? Would there be no recourse?
There is recourse, and the I believe Judge Russell was talking about the standards for setting aside a sale, and there, if the party can show through some fraud or unfairness,
is that unfairness enough, or is it just fraud?
It doesn't have to be fraud or unfairness or some other irregularity, or the sale was somehow manipulated improperly in a way, and it resulted in a grossly inadequate price being paid. And in fact, there's some suggestion in those cases that it may be the price may be so grossly inadequate that by itself that would be sufficient to set aside the sale, and then what you do is you'd have another sale. But the cases, if you look at the cases, this doesn't come close to being grossly inadequate to set aside the sale.
Back when I was practicing law involved in foreclosure sales, the bank or the lender always bid in the exact amount of the debt owed. Why are banks not doing that now, or how much do they have to do to avoid a substantial irregularity or an equitable challenge?
I don't know that there's a bright line for that test, Your Honor. You're looking at how the sale was conducted. There's a case from 2009 in which the similar argument was made, and they found that the amount was not so grossly inadequate as to set aside the sale. And the court cited an earlier case in which they found that 40% of the value was not so grossly inadequate as to set aside the sale. We don't have anything close to that in this situation. And so there is a remedy here, and what that is available to a borrower who feels that what has happened at the foreclosure sale is so unfair and the amount paid is so grossly inadequate that it ought to be set aside and should not be enforced.
What is that remedy?
It's not this case. Pardon me, Your Honor.
What's the remedy if you file a lawsuit?
Well, you can move in equity to set aside the sale. And what they're asking to do is to change the measure of damages in all deficiency actions, which for the reasons we explain in our brief.
Which that, well, you're asking us to legislate from the bench. I mean, in this case, your opponents can lawyer up. But generally speaking, a lot of times people are foreclosed upon because they're unemployed, they have too much debt, they can't lawyer up and file lawsuits, which of course is provided for, and it's non-judicial foreclosures. It's not like unless someone brings a case, it doesn't get reviewed by the court, as opposed to other states that have judicial foreclosures. So it's really left up to the parties. But generally speaking, the parties aren't able to lawyer up.
Well, they are asking you to legislate.
That's a term of art.
and I won't ask you to explain what it means. But they are asking you to legislate. They are because there are states in which they have the rule that's been applied is that they're going to measure deficiency by fair market value, and I'll talk about the problems with that in a second, but that it only applies, for example, that applies in the situation where there's a residential foreclosure. That's not what we have here. We have a sophisticated developer who made a strategic decision to default on a loan.
But the rule that's in existence in 1940 applies to residential foreclosures or to business foreclosures.
The same rule applies across the board, and that's kind of the issue. A question I think Judge Breckenridge asked, or Judge Stith, what the statistics were, the statistics about how many foreclosures resulted in deficiencies and those types of things. And the fact is, no, the record is not developed in this case on that. We tried this case based on law that was in effect at the time that the agreements were entered into, at the time that we performed the agreement. It's they're coming in after the fact and asking that be changed. But that highlights why, if a change is going to be made, and we don't think one should be made, if a change is going to be made, it needs to be a legislative solution where this type of information can be developed, where these policy circumstances can be weighed.
Your opponent argues that this was a judicially created method of damages. And so since it was created or adopted by the courts wouldn't be legislating if they changed it and if they considered the significance of 35 states who now use a different method of damages. So could you address that argument?
Sure. First of all, and I'd like to highlight that the vast majority, I don't know that our addition comes up, the vast majority of those 35 states adopted it legislatively because, and so they considered all these ramifications and the policy issues. The court does have the authority to change the rule, but this rule is now interwoven with the statutory foreclosure scheme, and a change in this will affect how that process plays out. It's not something where you're just talking about evidence at a deficiency hearing. You're talking about a consideration that any lender is going to have to take into account in deciding whether to make a loan if they don't have the opportunity for a deficiency based on the foreclosure sale, but instead are saddled with the risk, even though they're not the ones defaulting, they're saddled with the risk that upon an attempted resale, they will not be able to recover fair market value or an appraiser's opinion of fair market value.
And in that case, the banks and the business community would not have the ability to fairly to maybe give out as many loans or maybe finance as many purchases because they don't know what the risk is.
Well,
we changed the rule from 1940, and also the parties both knew what they were getting into when they signed the agreements when they property was sold.
That's correct, Your Honor. And what in the amicus brief, again, information that would be developed in the legislature if this consideration was given to changing this would be that you would that it would decrease the availability of credit or that it would increase the cost of loans, that interest rates would go up. The banks are going to have to address this, because what they're saddled with in the situation when with the fair market value standard is you're talking about somebody coming in and giving a fair market value, or an appraiser giving an opinion of market value, which even Mr. Westover acknowledged was an opinion. And presumably on the date of foreclosure, which may have nothing to do with what's happening in the market in the weeks or months or 3 years later, as is the case, as has happened in this case. And so who is going to bear that risk? Should it be the defaulting borrower who's got the benefit of the loan, who's
but
used that
fair market value if there's no market?
Well, if nobody's buying any property, then that's consistent with the bank's position that it's unfair to say that they have to suffer a reduction in the amount due on the loan in the amount of an appraiser's opinion as to fair market value, because they are stuck with property that they can't sell. What the appellant keeps arguing is that we have manipulated. They state at page 59 of their substitute brief that we manipulated this sale or conducted a foreclosure sale that ensured a windfall, and it's based on the fact that we now have an asset worth, according to them, $900,000. We don't have an asset worth anything if we can't sell it. And it's unfairly shifting the burden or the risk to the lender that this property is not going to be sold for what some appraiser says it was worth. And to show the speculative nature of what these types of appraisals, if on page 18 of Exhibit B, Mr. Westover, where he's talking about giving his opinion about the fair market value or what he thinks the market value of the property is, this is as of the fall of 2008. He says, it appears now that we may be near the bottom of this slowdown, with projections turning upward in the next year to 18 months. Well, could you be more wrong, I guess?
Paid for the study? Who paid for the fair market? Who paid for the appraisal?
That appraisal, there were two appraisals. One was done by a bank, but that particular appraisal was paid for by the borrower in this case. I'd also, there's a statement made that we have admitted that it was unfair. And I would just quickly refer the court to pages legal file 293 and 294, which is Mr. LeCamp's testimony. And what was read into the record by the appellant is a portion of that deposition testimony. And two lines after where the appellant stopped quoting, the exchange of 293 and 294 is, it's not fair to the borrower. This is called about how they calculated the 466. And Mr. LeCamp says, no, that's not what I meant. And the question is, then, what did you mean? And Mr. LeCamp says, no, I think it is fair, because he had explained, and as he explained at trial, why it was appropriate for them to further reduce the value beyond this appraiser's opinion, because, in fact...
Judge Fisher, you had... You were,
no, I'm fine.
Judge Brokamper, did you want to say something?
I'm fine.
I see that my time is up. We would ask the court to affirm the trial judge's order granting a new trial in this case as a result of the giving of an improper instruction.
Thank you very much. Mr. Weaver.
May it please the court. I think the most important issue to address initially is this idea of risk. The banks and the amicus go at great length to try to get the idea that there is some unfair shifting of risk that would come along with the restatement provision. Really, risk goes to the property owner. Prior to the foreclosure sale, the borrower who owns the property takes the risk that the property is going to go down or going to go up.
But does the bank assume we're going to have this 1940 case on the books, and if something goes wrong, then they have a means of collecting it, which may be to their advantage when they make the loan?
Well, they have the means to invoke the deed of trust and take the property. But once they decide to take the property, which is not required, if they didn't want this property, they didn't have to foreclose on it, but they took a valuable asset. And once they took that asset, it has a value on the day it was taken. If it declines in value later, they're now the property owner. It's their risk.
And I understand your equitable arguments and opposing counsel's equitable arguments, but in most of those cases that follow that use fair market value, whether for just residential or for all property, they do it by statute. So it's in effect prospectively, so it affects contracts entered into after the date of the statute. You're asking us to apply it to existing deeds of trust and existing transactions which were entered into under different law. How is the fact that other states choose to do that through their legislature by statute precedent for what you're asking us to do?
Your Honor, we have cited you examples where this court has
changed. But the policy issue that I'm addressing, you haven't addressed in your brief, nor I think do those examples.
It is within the power of this court to change the law. It's judge-made law. And here, this is not an example where the banks were relying to their detriment upon the existing law.
You're not asking us to change it for this case. Whatever we do here will affect all the everybody who goes into foreclosure from here forward if we adopt what you say, I presume. So why is that fair to do here? And what in the cases addresses that issue and says it's fair in the cases that have done it under the common law?
I think the important point here, Your Honor, is the banks were not relying upon this law to their detriment. They're using it to their advantage to gain a windfall.
Well, you say here, that, but the parties in a sophisticated business transaction, commercial parties, commercial property, both of those parties come to the table and have to assume the market risk that's involved inherent in both of their businesses. Why should they have to also factor in an assumption that a court would change the law that's been in effect for this long?
Well, Judge, I think with all due respect, that is just that's the world. We know that when the courts have an opportunity to review existing law, if they find that it is inappropriate, that it is no longer a standard that should be followed, if it is showing its age because of the change in the world, laws get changed, and sophisticated parties like banks know that that is a risk, and here it's not to their detriment. It just prevents them from...
But the legislature could have done the same thing.
It hasn't. But this is court-made law, which the court should take the step on its own to change this law. I believe my time is out. I respectfully request that the court reverse the underlying decision and adopt the restatement.
Thank you very much.